Hey, this is Adam again from Carpooling with Adam, and today is looking at Chapter 2 from Competing Against Luck by Clayton M. Christensen. It's been too long. I just looked, and it's been over a month and a half since I did my last episode, but I'm trying to be better and be back at it. So here we are, and I'm coming to you recording this in the bowels of my personal headquarters, if you will, so... very informal, very unrefined, but here we go. So chapter two is entitled Progress, Not Products. And as much as I hate to read, there's a short paragraph here that's called The Big Idea and what this chapter is about. That's going to kind of help prime my mind for the questions at the end of the chapter for leaders to think on. But I'm just going to read the premise of this chapter. The more we think we know, the more frustrating it becomes that we keep getting innovation wrong. But you don't have to leave your fate to luck. Successful innovations don't result from understanding your customers' traits, creating jazzy new bells and whistles for your products, catching hot trends, or emulating your competitors. To elevate innovation from hit or miss to predictable, you have to understand the underlying causal mechanism. The progress a consumer is trying to make in particular circumstances. Welcome to the theory of jobs to be done. Right? So he's starting to introduce the whole premise of this book of jobs to be done. I want to just talk about some of these ideas first before we get to the question, because as I read that, there were some thoughts and insights I had there. First of all, successful innovations don't result from understanding your customers' traits, creating jazzy new bells and whistles for your products, catching hot trends, or emulating your competitors. Let's talk about that bit. There's a bunch in there. Let's just start from the beginning. Understanding your customers' traits, right? Understandably, there's a lot of focus on creating customer personas, and I see a lot of activities around this, and trying to identify who your customer is, and I think all those are good thought exercises, but I think even in doing so, I think it depends on how you frame that. Often the ones I've seen, they say, okay, well, we've got the personas identified, and it, you know, maybe it's sometimes it's pretty quick, and somebody just off the top of their head spouts it out. Sometimes it takes weeks or months of lots of meetings and discussions by a committee trying to come up with these personas. In the end, as I've worked with development teams, they still tend to be kind of high level and superficial and don't really meet the intended goal of guiding the decisions and the product the thing you're trying to build, right? So I think that alone, I like that he's talking to that effect, right? So successful innovations don't come from that alone. Yet I see a lot of organizations of that's the extent of their investment, and if it doesn't result in anything suitable at the end, you know, then it's a waste of time, really. This next one, I personally see a ton of creating jazzy new bells and whistles. Oh my gosh. Doesn't that just define the software industry, right? They don't understand their customers well enough. They don't understand the market and all these different dynamics that come into play. So let's just keep throwing new features and new things at them. And hopefully that will close the deal. Or then we'll know which ones stick and we can move on from there. The feedback can be valuable. However, the approach I see taken is usually a very expensive, wasteful one that I argue is not necessary, right? Having an entire dev team trying to build or flesh out a feature haphazardly because they have a limited direction to go on to begin with. Well, sorry, there's my talking cough again. that's expensive. If you've got half a dozen software developers and testers and other people involved in that process working for a month, or I've seen several months, and I dare say over a year even, trying to figure out something and implementing one feature after another, and then they implement it, and, oh, that doesn't seem to land. Well, let's refine the feature, or let's do another one. And just in this constant state of churn, that's expensive. And quite frankly, you're wasting a lot of time that you wouldn't have to if you did a little more of the work up front and the work that's described in this book that so few companies actually do. Catching hot trends. Ugh, I've seen this one so many times too. Just because it's a trend doesn't mean it's right for you and your customers. It's not like you're hitching your wagon to the latest shooting star that's going to pay off for you in a big way like you think it has someone else or everyone else, right? Either generalizations are just as false. So what? Trends, and think about the word trend there just for a second. Trend, last I checked, the definition is not long-term and lasting, reliable. None of that are associated with trends. They come and go. If you're in some kind of product or service or business where that's your job to catch on to trends, then maybe that makes sense. But where I most often see this applied, unfortunately, is to companies who are looking for more long-term relationships and agreements and purchases and subscriptions from their customers. So catching trends is kind of dangerous, or a lot of dangerous. Or emulating your competitors. Heard this one for years too. Well, our competitor's doing this, so we've got to mirror it. Okay, no. Initially reject that idea, because that by itself means nothing. Do you understand why your competitors are doing that? Why is it that they've decided to go that route? What are they responding to? You got to ask these questions. You can't just take these superficial notions and run with them. It's such a mess when you do. Maybe what your competitor is doing doesn't make sense. Maybe they're totally missing the mark. Why on earth would you want to mirror or respond to that? And if you don't know, and so you're going based, that's even more scary to think about for me. We can't figure it out for ourselves, so let's chase what our competitors are chasing. Yikes. Promise you, that's not going to work out the way you hope. So, like he says, the very next point is everything he just described is hit or miss, unpredictable, risky, dangerous, right? Insert any kind of similar adjective there that you think applies. How about you have to understand the underlying causal mechanism? And it's hard, and you have to be smart, and you have to put in the effort to figure out what that is. And it requires a lot of understanding, and it requires a lot of experience. But you hear those words I'm mentioning, the risk starts to diminish when you do that, right? And there's always people who respond to these kinds of statements as though... Well, you got to take a risk, you know, risk big to win big, you know, those kind of phrases, as if any sort of risk, no matter the magnitude, could potentially pay off. Well, no. And nor do I agree with that a huge risk equals a huge reward, right? There's not as much correlation there as people would like to think. So those kind of platitudes don't matter. You got to understand the underlying causal mechanism. You just have to. So to the extent that you invest in doing that,
you're putting yourself in a much better position to understand what kind of progress are you trying to help your customers make. Maybe I need to talk more in meetings at work so I don't have this problem. Said no one ever. All right. So that's the premise of the chapter. And of course, he goes through that in more detail. And he always gives some good examples and illustrations and real world ones, for that matter, that I always find very interesting. Excuse me. All right, so questions. Because that's what I like to focus on. Something to think about. Do you understand the real reason why your customers choose your products or services, or why they choose something else instead? Okay. Do you understand the real reason why? Why is bolded and italicized there in that question? You've got to get there. And I can tell you right now, if the best you can do is knee-jerk gut responses, you don't understand why. That's just not – it's to really, really understand why requires some investment. And it's not something that just a survey is going to resolve. It's not something that reading an article that you think is relevant in a business magazine is not going to get you there. Any one of those things by themselves is very superficial, very minimal effort, and therefore is going to give you very minimal, very superficial rewards. Why are they picking your product? Is it because it's the cheapest? Is it because you have a recognizable brand? And why are they going with somebody else? Somebody else because they're cheaper? Because their brand's more recognizable, right? God, there's got to be some other reasons there that I'm trying to think of, some real-world ones that I've seen. Why do people choose products? Yeah, unfortunately, maybe they do it for superficial reasons. Maybe the person who ultimately agrees to the deal and signs it and buys your products isn't the end user. So there's already some inherent disconnect built in there. But you need to understand that, right? Just because a salesperson gets the CFO to sign off on something doesn't mean it's a great fit for the organization and the users in the organization are going to benefit it. No. There's got to be some work and effort put into making sure that you really understand why they're buying your products. Maybe you've had a great marketing campaign and it was convincing and it got people to buy the product. But in the end, if you don't understand better why, it's not going to land, right? The next time something better comes, the price is one of the biggest ones of this, right? I hate to keep focusing on that one because I'd like to cover more breadth of topics than that. But if you're expensive and there's no other reason to differentiate and you offer no other value than your competitor, then the cheapest person's going to win, right? And that doesn't do them any favors nor you, right? That's a lose-lose if that's the only differentiation is price, unless it's some kind of market or commodity where that really is the only case, right? Where they're the exact same thing essentially and there's the only way to differentiate the price, maybe that makes sense. But most of the time, that's not going to be the case. So I wouldn't rely on that very heavily, if at all. And I have seen where companies will ask people who leave them, you know, why did you leave? Maybe that helps. Sometimes you're going to get people who are going to be honest. Sometimes they're going to give you useful feedback. Sometimes they're not. Maybe they don't want to tell you the reason you're leaving. Think about if you've ever left a company or a job before, they want to have that exit interview and ask you why you're leaving. Maybe you're honest, maybe you're not. I mean, it just depends, right? Sometimes I've heard people be honest and very nicely express and outline it out. And it doesn't matter anyways. The HR person's just documenting it and sticking it in your file, you know, so what? Well, so that isn't useful. Other times, you know, somebody's flamed and enraged and burned some bridges, and some people don't want to do that, so they just don't say anything, right? It's all over the place what you're going to get from that. So that alone isn't 100% reliable and absolutely an effective way to determine that. So the next question is, how do your products or services help your customers to make progress in their lives? In which circumstances are they trying to make that progress? Interesting, right? Not just... It's a really good question. Not just how does it help them make progress in their lives, but in what circumstances does it help? Can you see how it takes it to another level and to a much deeper understanding? And a deeper understanding can always help you make better decisions. I'm trying to think, sorry, I have to keep flipping back because I don't have that great of a... I'm thinking at the same time I'm reading and trying to remember stuff, and apparently that's more... I'm asking a bit much of myself there. Understand their circumstances. What's the impetus for them looking? Is it they're trying to meet some new governmental regulation? Has their market changed in some way? Has their customer base changed? Did a large group of their customer base suddenly find themselves going out of business in a market downturn or whatever, right? And I would just add there, just going based off investor calls, that's not anywhere near deep enough information to give you any kind of indicator there. So if you take that information and then try and extrapolate on your own from there, I would shy away from that. You're not getting into a deeper level understanding by just bouncing along the superficial stuff and then making it up from there. Put some frame to that. Put some skeleton to it, and then give yourself something to build out from, right? Don't just take a single concept and build a straw man from there. And this is interesting. So to help you consider this further, functional, emotional, and social dimensions of this progress, right? What, you know, as I think about this, what I see most often with these kinds of considerations, this level, they're harder. And people don't want to maybe acknowledge that, shoot, there might be an emotional component involved. There is. I promise you there is, because when I talk to customers, I hear it. I see it. They tell me about it, right? An end user who's frustrated with your software and hate how it functions and it's frustrating and hard to learn, do they care that the CFO thought it was the best purchase? No. So yet they're having this reaction. Maybe there's something you can do about that. Maybe not, right? Obviously, we're all humans and emotion is part of humanity and we can't necessarily address that. But if you can, great. If your product and service can address that effectively, great. If not, at least understanding that, again, that's just that many more arrows in your quiver and that much more in your understanding of things that will help you in making these decisions. And functional and social dimensions. Years ago, lots of years, I had a job where I was basically a territorial rep for the company I worked for. And I met with all different kinds of customers. My customers were marketing firms, tax consultancy firms, construction companies, manufacturing, warehouse, all kinds, right? And I go in and I talk to them, the owners and the employees of those different companies. And very, very different social dimensions in each of those places and operations, right? My interactions with the dudes on a construction site were very different when I'm walking onto the site where they're in January framing a house up versus walking into a nice heated office and sitting down in a conference room with, you know, a spread of food and beverages on the table. Very different social dynamics. There's still the element of humanity always present, of course, but the social dynamics are very different on the construction site. How the employees interact with their supervisor or boss, very, very different than the interactions you would see between employees and managers and supervisors in a business or an office setting, right? Very, very different. And that factors in. That plays into, if you're trying to really do something that helps them make improvements, helps them make progress, so helpful to understand that. And once I understood those different dynamics, I interacted with those different businesses in different ways. The way I showed up to give information to some dudes who just finished pouring cement, right, were very different than how I interacted with people in an office. And I had to learn that and be able to handle that effectively. If I walked into the office talking to the guys like I did on the construction site, not necessarily, it's just different. I'm not just talking about swearing or crass, that kind of stuff, but just their way of understanding and interacting with you and with the world they're very, very different, very contrasting. And once I figured that out, I was much more effective in my role in getting them the services that they needed. Right? If I go to a guy's, like a shop I had that was metal and machine fabricating, talking to them about our safety and consulting services and helping them get OSHA certified, different. Am I going to walk into an office and have the same conversation about how you need a hazardous materials handling? No, right? So there's a lot there. There's a lot there to understand and figure out. And functional, how the different customers operate. Is it an individual? Then understand why they're making that purchase and how it helps them. What processes it help them with? What does it alleviate? What does it make easier for them? All kinds of functional things to look at and examine and explore. All right, and then this last question here. Then look at what's competing. Kind of I think, was it the first question? Or was it in the... Yeah, or one of the first questions. Looking at competition. Not to just mirror them or mimic them, but why? Why are they buying a different software? Why are they paying for a different service? Would they rather just have a consultant? Why? Right? Understand why they would do that. What factors go into them making that decision? And then see how your competitors are meeting them. Don't just assume because your competitors have sales, well, they must be. Well, no. Maybe they're getting it totally wrong and they're writing a nice marketing campaign and having a lot of sales, but when it comes to actually delivering on that marketing campaign, they could fall short. And if you understand why that could happen, who's in a better position to avoid it or to respond if those things do shift or change, right? Then you are, if you understand that. No reason to just follow their lead. And then this one's interesting too. Are there competitors that maybe are outside the norm don't fall within the traditional view of that industry? I think this is illustrated if you think about when you see someone else enter maybe a market you're in that's not been in that market typically, and suddenly they show up with an offering, right? And at first everyone's going, wait, what are they doing here? Who invited them to the party, right? It happens though. and understand why. Why would they make a jump into a market like that? What makes them think they're positioned for that? Don't just dismiss them, right? Ask why. Let's say, okay, say, how about you? It's better exercise, in my opinion, to assume they must have a legitimate stake or foot or reason for being here. Let's understand what that is. Fine if you don't think they do, but understand why they think they do, right? Don't just be so quick to dismiss or discredit them because they're a threat and you don't want to even have to consider that. Now, spend some time. Understand, why are they jumping in here? Did they purchase a competitor and that's why they're in that space now to be in that space? Well, it would be really good to understand why, not just so you understand them. It's not just about knowing your enemy. That helps you understand yourself better. Maybe there's something about that dynamic or event that helps you understand better what your position should be and what your offering should be. There could be a lot to learn from that. And maybe I'll just kind of wrap up and end on that note for this episode. All of these things, as I'm thinking about it and talking about it, provide you opportunities to learn. And maybe not learn in a traditional sense either, right? This isn't learning by, it's more an applied way, or applied learning, I guess, is a better way to describe it, because it's not just about, well, you read a book, or you went to a seminar, or you went to a conference, or you got a newsletter. Those are all cool things, and early on in my career, I was kind of ravenous for signing up for that stuff, just because I learned so much from it. And that's what's valuable, is the learning that you gain from that. And then, obviously, that needs to be preceded by your ability and your willingness to learn. If you just go into full defensive mode and it's all about protecting you and your company and your customers, survival and defensive isn't openness and willingness to learn, and you're going to miss stuff, and that's going to be detrimental to you. So I guess make the effort to learn, to really dive in, have a deeper level of understanding. It's always going to pay off, whether it pays off in your products or services, pays off in how you manage your business, how you structure it, right? All those things can be influenced in a positive way and benefit you, your business, your customers, your employees. Which really, doesn't that sound like more of a better end goal than, oh, we're just matching what our competitor's doing, or we're just trying to be number one in this market for number one's sake? Well, why? Does that make you more profitable? It's not a guarantee. I used to joke about a local business magazine. Every month had their rankings, top 100, top 10, top 25. A lot of national magazines do this too, right? Like Inc. and others. They have these rankings. And it was always so funny to me, and it's why I lost interest in these publications, because so many of them the businesses and companies I saw at the top, it was so short-lived. Often from one year to the next, there would be a dramatic shift and change, and they would go out of business, or they would fall way low down in the rankings. Not just slipping one or two spots. That happened, of course, but I was surprised by how much fluctuation and change there is in those rankings, which in the end, then that means those rankings, I don't know what purpose they have other than, you get some marketing mileage out of that, but then if that changes next year, what was that worth anyway, right? I don't know. So, better understanding helps you know what your goal should be, and also, how to get there. Much more enabling thing than all these other superficial things that I mentioned. Of just matching your competition or dismissing or all these other things that don't enable you
and actually have quite the opposite effect. Anyway, well, it's gone a little longer than normal, but hopefully this has been interesting. Certainly been good for me and helped my thoughts mature and improve and bake a little better. And if I can get the coughing thing under control, maybe verbalize and communicate them better. But thanks, thanks for listening. For any of you who have, feel free to reach out and ask me questions. I love to discuss this kind of stuff. I dare say it's kind of one of my hobbies, but not just for hobby's sake necessarily. Something I enjoy because progress and improvement is something I'd love to learn about and understand better and figure out how to do. So anyways, that's the end of episode 2. Hope you have a good day. Bye.